across the UK, across continental North America, and around the world, on the internet, by webcast, and by podcast. My name is Howard Hughes, and this is The Return of the Unexplained. By the looks of it, over the last few days, the return of summertime here. We've had some very nice weather. Looking a little dull right now as I record this, but my fingers are crossed for something better. That's the weather report. I hope the weather's good wherever you are. Thank you very much for all of your emails. I'm not going to be doing any shout-outs on this edition for a very big reason. That's because of the quality of the guest we have here. We'll need every second we can possibly muster. For this particular guest, her name is Dr. Carmen Bolter, and she's in Canada. I'll tell you more about her in just a moment, but I'm really pleased to have got her. Thank you for the emails. Thank you for the donations that you've made. If you can make a donation to the show, please do. And if you have made a donation recently, thank you from the bottom of my heart, because it's rocket fuel for us to continue doing this work, which you tell me around the world that you appreciate. Now, unfortunately, my unexplained schedule is running a little bit behind now. You know that, for reasons that I know are quite boring, I have to go out and do shifts in regular journalistic work on radio just to be able to pay my bills and to eat. So I have to apportion my time very carefully, and I have to make as much time as I can for the unexplained, because that is my labor of love, and that's what I want to develop. So if I lose a show along the way, it's a little bit of a minor disaster, and that's what's just happened to me. I'm not going to name any names here, but I've been through a remarkable experience that has left me a little demoralized about it all, but I guess I was due for one of these. I had a problem with a guest, somebody who sent round an email suggesting that we interview him, and I thought, okay, looks like an interesting guy, looks like interesting work that he's done. But unfortunately, I was in a situation that I really couldn't get myself out of, and the situation was this, and I wonder what you think about this. Obviously, I try and do this program to broadcast standards, and if people make claims that are possibly questionable or might attract legal action, then I have to cut those parts out. Mostly, these conversations run exactly as they recorded. Richard Hoagland, for example, the last show was exactly as we recorded it. No edits. And most of them, most of these 200 and whatever it is now, 208 shows, have had very few cuts made in them. And I've been lucky over the years. You know, I've had guests who've been good. Some of them you've found controversial. Some of them you haven't really agreed with. But mostly you've come along on the journey with me. And I've only really had to not run two shows up to now. Well, now that number is three, because the person that I interviewed, because I had to make some cuts in the show, but I did them legally and fairly, and all of this took hours and hours of my time, then subsequently told me a number of things. He told me that the show had to run exactly as we recorded, no edits, or he wouldn't give permission. Which, of course, he'd already given by agreeing to be interviewed, but that's another issue. And number two, he accused me of being an establishment shill. Well, look, I've been accused of many things over the years, but establishment, I ain't. And that's just a fact. And, you know, if some people don't believe that, what can I do about that? You know, I am not establishment, and I'm certainly not directed by them. So I found the whole experience both demoralizing and bizarre. But I'm glad I've seen the back of it. What it means anyway, to get to the point, is that what would have been edition 208 has had to be deleted and scrapped and forgotten about, and we now move on to what would have been edition 209 with a very, very special guest and a remarkable person. I've been looking at her work online today and reading about her, and the more I see and the more I read, the more enthusiastic I get. Her name is Dr. Carmen Bolter. She is, well, one of the many things that she does, director, producer, writer of The Pyramid Code, a documentary series you may have seen. It's been on air in 38 countries. It's on Netflix in 7 countries. And it is the most remarkable and the most revealing series about ancient Egypt that I've ever seen. You know, until I'd seen that series, I don't think I knew anything about ancient Egypt. And I've done interviews about it here, but my learning curve begins here with Dr. Carmen Bolter, who I think is going to amaze you And we'll also bring you some news that you may not have heard elsewhere, and it is pretty big news. So please stay here on The Unexplained for Dr. Carmen Bolter in the west of Canada very, very soon. Thank you for your emails. Thank you to Adam Cornwell, my webmaster at Creative Hotspot in Liverpool, for his input and his help in keeping the website ticking over like a Swiss watch. www.theunexplained.tv. That's where you can send me a donation or send me an email through the site. And thank you very much for your support. No shout-outs on this edition. A lot to do. We'll have shout-outs in a future edition. A lot of people talking about Richard Hoagland, by the way. A lot of adverse email and a lot of you saying that you felt that he was rude to me in the show. Well, I think that Richard is massively enthusiastic and sometimes maybe can come across that way. But it kind of goes with the territory. You know, some of you like the show very much, but I've had an avalanche of email telling me that you had issues with this particular one. So, you know, I hear what you say, and I'm going to go through some of your emails in the next edition. But I find Richard Hoagland a fascinating guest, and as I've always said with him, even if not everything that he says is absolutely on the money, even if only some of it might be, he's pointing the way to questions that are pretty fundamental for all of us, don't you think? And that's all I know. Okay. Let's get to Dr. Carmen Bolter now in the west of Canada. Carmen, thank you very much for coming on The Unexplained.
Thanks for inviting me.
Well, listen, I'm really delighted that you're doing this because you know nothing about me and your work is at a high level and I know you've been on a lot of big shows. So the fact that you're willing to do this across the United Kingdom and the United States and Canada, of course, and Australia and New Zealand with me is a real delight. And even more so, Carmen, because I've spent a goodly part of the last evening and this day checking out your work. And I have to say, I feel enormously guilty and somewhat chastened that I hadn't discovered you before now, because I watched the series, the Pyramid Code, and was, again, humbled by the quality of work and the fact that there is so much in this, and yet it is delivered in an almost understated way. You're not throwing this material at people. You're not saying, gee whiz, look at this. It's not full of bangs and flashes and visual effects. It's just what it is. It's brilliant. So, you know, congratulations to you and the team involved in that.
Thank you.
So there are five of those. They are available online, and they are on Netflix, I believe, and 38 countries they're seen in. But that is just a portion of you. Before we talk about a discovery, which is the only word to use for it, that you've been involved in very recently, I think I need to introduce you to my listeners, and we need to talk about you, this lifelong passion that you have for ancient Egypt. I read somewhere that it's a lifelong passion that that even you believe goes beyond this life. Is that so?
It definitely does. It's where science and spirituality meet.
Okay, that sounds good. What does that mean?
Well, past lives. I started having past life memories as a little girl, and by the time I was 32, I had memories of 85 past lives of my own, and then I stopped counting. So three very important lives were in Egypt, and I feel like I'm looking around for things I remember at the cellular level. And that actually can be shown scientifically now. And so, you know, I've really done a lot to bridge the spiritual with the scientific.
And when you say that of these 85 past lives, look, I think that I remembered as a small child one past life in California, right by the Pacific Coast Highway, and that's it as far as I'm concerned. 85, I can't imagine what that's like, but the three in ancient Egypt, with what clarity do you recall those?
Deep emotional clarity, and I've met a lot of people who were with me in those lives, and, you know, there's still a little bit of unfinished business, if you will, in a place that I have yet, well, I've yet to go into, but this has something to do with the discovery that you mentioned. Mm. So it was kind of like a game of hide and seek for the first several years. I first went to Egypt in 77 and everything all switched on inside me. It's like, oh yeah, I remember this. But then there's this place I was looking for. And I found myself, you know, getting warmer, getting cooler, leaving without finding it, having visions of it when I was back in Canada, going back to Egypt, getting warmer, getting cooler. It's got to be around here somewhere. Go to Upper Egypt. No, it's not there. And finally, after 10 years of this, of no, I found it. Definite yes. And I kicked my shoes off, and I didn't even realize that that high-level initiates didn't wear shoes in the temples. And then when I stepped on the stone, it started to run like a movie. I could smell the flowers. I could see the priestesses in their robes. I knew that around the corner of this wall, there would be a small door, and there was. And then I thought, okay, I found it. I really, really, really found it.
Well, this confluence, this is what is so fascinating about you, this confluence of the spiritual and the scientific. Look, you worked and work in academia. The fact that those two things come together in you is pretty unique. That is remarkable. Has that caused you problems over the years?
Well, not exactly, because I know which hat I'm wearing when, but it's definitely unique. But the thing is, because I've been teaching research methods, quantitative research methods, in the Graduate Division of Educational Research at the University of Calgary, now I'm retired from that, but that really brought the point home of how you can do scientific research on the paranormal. And there has to be the proper methodology, but, you know, it's possible. Like, so there's plenty of young children who go to a city and know what all the streets are going to be called, or look at a picture and say, that guy was married to a lady named Sally and they live two blocks over there. And they're right. And so it's possible to measure even auric fields and the effect that sacred sites have on people. So I research equipment, and there's scientific equipment out of Russia that is able to, you know, give levels to measure people before they go into a site and when they're at the site and after, to see what the effect is. And so I've done studies in many countries, and two in particular in the Great Pyramid. You know, so it's possible to do this. But the thing is too many people are standing on platforms saying, it's true because I said so, and I know, so I'm right, because I'm at the front and you're sitting down. And so replicating what they do in school, what they do on the news, and what they do on television and in Hollywood. So it actually, if you say, this is true and this is who did it, it's actually a work of fiction. Because what they train us to do in the PhD programs is to hedge. From the data we have now, it seems to indicate it could be, right? Because we can't just go and say it is, it's from Atlantis, it, you know, Atlantis was founded in, you know, 13,000 BC. You know, you don't know that for sure. You can't verify it. And so I've really worked hard to make sure that I'm not talking through my hat and that I'm, you know, joining something. And that's what the Pyramid Code was. It was taking the indigenous wisdom keeper and finding someone else who would say something from a scientific standpoint that lined up with what Hakim said. And so everything has to be tied to something real. And there's way too much out there that is fiction. And lots of people in this age of, you know, self-publishing and being on the speaker circuit, of people who really don't quite know how to do the research.
Right, and primary research is where it's at. The one thing that sometimes frustrates me about people I talk to on here is that you try to go as forensically as you can, as a generalist, a journalist I am, into what they are telling you. And it becomes clear, depressingly, as you get 30% into the conversation, that much of what they know is what they've read from other people. They have not done primary research. And certainly in this ancient Egypt field, going there and experiencing and checking and double checking is what it's all about, isn't it?
Well, yes, but look what the media has done to discourage people from going to Egypt. I was just there a few weeks ago. It's perfectly fine. Right back to 1977. Oh, no, you shouldn't go there. It's dangerous. Right the way through till now, they always tell you it's dangerous. You get there, it's safer than here.
No, well, that's news to me. I mean, I'm in Europe and I'm not too far from Egypt. Right now, I want to go, but I would be scared to. Because, you know, I would be afraid, well, you know what I would be afraid of, because a lot of people in North America and here in Europe are afraid of coming into contact with the kinds of people who don't like people like us.
But it's not even true. The thing is, that's the propaganda that they repeat and repeat and repeat. And when I land in Egypt, the beauty is that all that propaganda is missing, and they haven't been watching our news. They're happy as can be. They wear their hearts on their sleeve. They're delighted to see us. And they, you know, it's just so safe. You can walk down the street by yourself at 2 o'clock in the morning. I can, without worrying. I mean, it's safe. It's incredible. And all of this, the terrorists are hiding around the corner, is just something they repeat and repeat and repeat. And when you get there, you don't hear that repeated. It's not in the cultural fabric. It's not in the collective unconscious.
What we have to remember is that there are ordinary people the world over. Most people are ordinary, decent people. You know, I love traveling and I love meeting people. And the vast majority of people are not involved in, in acts of terrorism or preparation for them.
Not even close. I mean, let's not get too far into this, but there's all kinds of ways that the smoke and mirrors points the finger and the demonization of all things Middle Eastern, and it works. I've taken thousands of people over there over the years, thousands.
There must be agendas beyond our pay grade, I'm sure, to do with all of this. Now, as I watched the Pyramid Code and as I read about you, I came to a thought. And then, lo and behold, in one of the editions, I think it might have been number 2 or maybe number 5, but I think it was number 2, you said exactly what I started to think. You said, the fact of the matter is, we are not the most evolved that we've ever been. Now, that's a big surprise to an awful lot of us, because we think that in our technological society, with our flat-screen TVs and our fantastic smartphones and Windows 10 coming on, that we are just about the bee's knees when it comes to technology. And the fact of the matter is, when you look at ancient Egypt, it isn't what we've been told it is from the research that you've done and from what we're more and more hearing. The view I got at school was connected with Tutankhamun, that ancient Egypt was about hierarchical society, almost obsessed with death and dying in the afterlife, and that's about it.
Yeah, well, again, propaganda. Somebody gives the storyline about what's supposed to, what we're supposed to know about something, and they repeat it and repeat it and repeat it and repeat it until they believe it, and then we're supposed to believe it, and no one challenges it, and it just isn't true. So when I spent time in Egypt by myself, I'd stand next to some tour guides and listen to them talk about certain things, like this is Ramses Temple, and I'd feel like I was going to pass out. Like someone had punched me in the stomach. And I'm like, well, why am I having such a reaction here? Because it isn't Ramses. That happens to be Amenhotep III, Akhenaten's father. And all the stuff they say about King Tut and the situation that he grew up in, and Akhenaten being, closing all the temples and Nefertiti and, making it one god, it's not true. So there's almost nothing that's been written about that period of time that's correct. And that is one of the periods of time that I feel very close to. And so I've just set out to set the record straight as much as I can. And no, we are deaf. I mean, do you think blood from death is sophisticated? Mm. You think any kind of war is right? This idea of a few people getting all the prize and everybody else suffers, is that's not very sophisticated.
And with you, it's all overlaid with this other dimension that you are not only a quester, if that's the word, after the truth of ancient Egypt, but you are compelled to go back there because you believe that you've been there before.
Well, it's because I feel comfortable there, because I've been there before. And I'm more interested in it than I am in our society. I think our society is leading a lot of us down the wrong path. And yeah, I guess you can say I'm addicted to it. Every time I keep trying to break away, but it doesn't seem to work.
But my connection with the work of yours that I've, looked at over this last 12 hours or thereabouts, we spoke, didn't we, last night, and you prepared the ground for some of this. I just don't know how I could have got it, and a lot of people I know, I went to university and stuff, and I'm supposed to be reasonably intelligent, but we're fed this tourist notion of the pyramids as being on one site, big pyramid in the middle, couple of small pyramids either side, there's the Sphinx, that's it. It couldn't be further from the truth. So I'm annoyed with myself, really, that I've sort of bought the tourist view of it.
Yep, and if you're going to go, they have to have a guide. The guide has to learn the scripts. They talk about the latest dynasties and how Ramses, cut the hands off of his enemies and, warring versions of Egypt. Well, all that started in the patriarchal era of Egypt, which started in 3113 BC with the dynasties. But my interest is also the pre-dynastic and the distant past, where there were civilizations that are not what you see there. There's something else, there's something far older, and it's still been hidden. And I think we've got a clue now, a leg up into what it might be.
Right, which I we keep teasing people, I want to get to. I just want to lay the groundwork for this. But what is there is, number one, the rudiments of it, the beginning of your path to discovery, anybody's path to discovery there. It's not difficult to find. All of the stuff is there. You've just got to go and find it. There is a line, isn't there? There is a corridor of pyramids and ruins that will tell you a story.
Well, not if they're telling you the wrong story. So you still get the guides that will tell you that the pyramids were tombs and they were obsessed with death and they worshipped animals and all of those traits. But the other thing is that you can stand in the temples and not really know what you're looking at when you're looking at those pictures. So I started, you know, taking pictures and poring over them in between trips. And it's even recently I've been looking at the same pictures and all of a sudden I'll see something I didn't notice before or I didn't know how to interpret. That's one part. The other part is because of the way the temples were built with sacred geometry, they actually replicate the cavities of the human body. And so you enter through the feet and go all the way up to the pineal gland where the Holy of Holies is at the back of the temple. And in their ideology, the populace could go into the first hypostyle hall, but then you had to have certain levels of initiation to go further and further and further. So the very act of standing in one of these temples could have a profound effect on the human psyche if we're able to communicate with ourselves and receive the meaning. And sometimes it takes a while for that to digest in at the cellular level. But Egypt is designed to have a dramatic effect on people's consciousness.
And when you're there, what do you feel?
Oh, I feel alive. I mean, what started happening with the Great Pyramid is I realized that I was becoming more psychic. And I wasn't even sure how to define that. And I thought, well, how can being inside the Great Pyramid make me more psychic? And so that is a major study that I've done, the effect of the Great Pyramid on the human aura and the chakra system. And I used this electrophotonic imaging technology to measure that. And it actually, and so in the Pyramid Code, you see the goddess standing inside a sphere, and you hear Hakim talking about 360 senses. Which another way of saying that is full spectrum senses. And so synesthesia is cross-sensory perception. And I worked as a psychologist for 17 years. And so that synesthesia is a phenomena that can be measured where you hear a picture and see music and, you know, the deep feelings where the hair stands up on your arms and you know, you have a sense of knowing. But what would psychicness be? And so what I started thinking that the entrainment of the chakras, where the chakras are actually relaying information, so with the cross-sensory perceptions happening at the cellular level, and that's the definition, in a way, of psychicness. You could, you know, read the paper to see how all that fits together in the literature review. But then I went along and measured how people were connected before they went in, and then what happened when they lay in the sarcophagus for 2 minutes, and then what and how it settled after. And then with large groups of people, you can do a statistical analysis on the data. And sure enough, it looked like total harmony was going through the chakras. And so that is one way to explain that phenomena. And so it literally and figuratively has an effect on consciousness.
And the people who were there in ancient times, which is a rubbish way of putting it, but I can't think of any other, the people who were there back then, they must have been part of a process of evolution that had gone on for a very long time to refine the use of these techniques and to understand how they work to that extent must have taken thousands of years.
Well, perhaps the contrary is true, because it seems that Egypt sprung into action full-blown with the highest level of pyramids, the highest, most sophisticated technology, and then deteriorated over time. So somehow they came in with the knowledge. Now, if you break it down, and this has been something that I've also focused on, what were they really concerned about? And if you're going to put it into the nutshell here, two things, biology, how did we get here, and cosmology, what happened when you left. And they had no word for death. They had no word for it. So they understood that the human body was, we're borrowing it, and that our soul lives on. And they talk about that as the ba, and the ka is the body double. So they were very well versed in the idea of bilocation, because your ka could go to the other spot and your physical would stay where it is. And they even have body triple in the temples. I found that. So you see lots of these body doubles, but the ba is the part that lives on when you're dead. And so the ceremony of the weighing of the hearts has Anubis meet you when you pass out of the physical, and they say, okay, you're dead. And they go, what do you mean? I feel the same. They go, check it out. Your body's over there. Let's have your heart and see if you're light of heart to go to the other side. So the sarcophagus inside the Great Pyramid, inside the king's so-called king chamber, so-called sarcophagus, was the location of where high-level initiates one at a time would practice these out-of-body experiences, because they wanted to die, pass consciously. We still call it death. They called it westing, where they would go consciously to the other side, practice returning, so that when they actually did pass, they knew what to do, they knew what it looked like. And, you know, if you work with people who've had out-of-body experiences now, or near-death experiences, you know, they, or even people who pass and come back and communicate, they'll go, well, they didn't tell me about this in church.
But the idea of continuity, very, very important to them, it seems, even right down to the point, well, I say even right down, fundamentally, the point that, for example, Sirius appears for a period, then disappears below the horizon for a number of months and then reappears. That's continuity, isn't it?
Well, the thing is, though, is that it was the thing that triggered the flooding of the Nile, which made the rich silt go over the fields, which would tell them exactly how much harvest they would have. So they were able to predict. But then that got corrupt, and the Amun priesthood, we still say Amen, which were representing the darkness, you know, they would have a nilometer, and they would measure how far the water went, and you would have to give half your harvest to the temple. Well, that's what we're doing now. We're still giving half our harvest to the government, right? And so there's a lot of corruption that was covered up, and it's just really satisfying to get to the bottom of it and understand what they were really doing.
And one of the things that comes out, and was again a revelation to me, is that I always had this vision of a very hierarchical society, and for most ordinary Joes like you and me, if you didn't mind your P's and Q's, then off with your head. It wasn't entirely like that, was it? This seems to have been a society of engineers and scientists and experts and qualified people.
Well, let's just say in the larger cycles of time, in the processional cycle of 26,000 years, there's times for golden ages that dip down, bronze, silver, the other way around, silver, bronze, down into the Iron Age of density and darkness, which is where we live now, which is why it's a cosmic joke that we think we're so, you know, highly developed. And so the other thing is that matriarchal times, they were into balance between the masculine and the feminine. And so it wasn't hierarchical. If it wasn't good for everybody, it wasn't good at all. And it really was about helping humanity do well, feel abundance, feel, you know, the gratitude of all that. And so it's we're going to come to see the last 5,000 years as the patriarchal hiccup, I think, in the cosmic scheme of things. But the patriarchy's agenda has been to erase evidence of everything other than itself, and to set up a hierarchical pecking order with dominance, domineering people, disempowerment instead of self-empowerment. And that's hurting everyone.
No, you get no argument from me about that. Sophisticated engineering, superior science, that's a revelation to people too. We obviously, people say, oh, how did they build the pyramids? And with their various explanations as to how the stones were dragged there. But there's much, much more to all of this. For example, you believe they may have had some form of ancient power generation.
Mm-hmm. But also, they've tried, Japanese teams tried to do what they tell you, that put the stones, you know, on a barge and float them up the river and then get them off the barge and put them into a pyramid. And they did try, and they didn't get farther than 13 stones stacked. And then the Department of Antiquities told them to take it down. And so they weren't able to do it. And so our best guess at how they did it isn't how they did it, because we can't replicate it. And in fact, we don't have the technological capability to take the pyramids down, even with explosives. And they would not be standing there if we could have taken them down. And so I think we're looking at, and I said Ba and Ka, so abracadabra, Abba, Ra, Ka, they were using sound and light technology, and they had an understanding of a very, very refined energy field that allowed the transmutation of the atom, which would have included anti-gravity. But I also don't think the stones were carved, because there's a technique of geopolymers that once a stone is made artificially somewhat like cement, you can't tell the difference between the granite that was poured and the granite that wasn't. And so over the years, I started to notice in the temples how there's the structure of the temple, and then there was something that was poured over the top that was then the decorative part of it. And sometimes sheets of that fall off, and you can see that that was poured too. So, and if you think about places like Machu Picchu, or even in Egypt, Abu Roush, you have to go up a mountain before you go up the pyramid. And so how are you going to get the rocks up there? It just doesn't make any sense. But we are in a state where somebody repeats the thing over and over again. We go, oh, okay. However, there are many, many people who go, well, that doesn't make sense. And so what were they doing? Like, it, you know, there's some people, thankfully, that won't rest with a story that doesn't add up.
As you hinted, I think, just a moment ago, there are people who say that they understood the power of sound and resonant frequencies.
Mm-hmm.
And
well,
that could have been used.
Light. Pardon me?
And that could have been used as a way to move things. Do you understand how to harness sound?
Well, if you think about it, high in the mountains of Tibet, you go to these monasteries and they've got these huge trumpets, and they are levitating things with the sound of the trumpets up in Tibet right now. Okay. And so sound and light technology isn't something we're using, but it is something, well, I guess some people are using it, but anti-gravity, different devices that would allow for the stone to somehow become weightless. There's even talk in Peru, and all these cultures are somehow related, and I can explain that too. But they've got these two substances that they brew together that actually can soften the stone. And, you know, it looks like those stones down there are poured because they're, I call them marshmallow stones, because they look yeasted. And that's how the seams between them end up being so fine, because there's something like your mother's buns in the oven that would yeast and grow together. And so I think the technology is far beyond, you know, using chisels to carve things and slaves to on rollers to drag things. Because the other thing is, where are you going to stand when you get to the top of the pyramid? If it takes 100 people to put a stone up there, I mean, you're going to run out of room pretty quick. I mean, even just that kind of
logic. Yes, I've actually thought of that before. You know, as they're getting to the top of the thing, where is everybody, the team involved in this, where do they go?
Mm-hmm.
And there's no answer. And then, life being life, you just move on to another thought.
Well, if there's no answer, the thing is, though, you're sounds to me like you're the kind of person that isn't satisfied with the answers that you've been told and you notice. But if there's no conversation, nobody to talk to about it, then you kind of go, okay, oh, whatever, right?
One of the pyramids that you looked at, I think it was Abu Roush, a blackened stone within the pyramid, it had the look of, from what you said, of some kind of force being used for something in there.
Well, actually, it's each of the pyramids in the Band of Peace, from Abu Roush all the way down to Dahshur, all have signs of an explosion. And I am assuming, well, it's my conviction from the research that I've done, that it all happened at the same time. That the energy was overcharged, and maybe that means that devious forces got involved somehow, but that each of the pyramids cracked. And I'm telling you, if you see, well, the side of the sarcophagus, I mean, if you went in there with the biggest sledgehammer ever and smacked at that thing, you could not break the corner of that sarcophagus the way it's broken. And directly on the wall across from it is this huge crack in the wall. So something exploded. And I think that it was, I call it fields within fields within fields. So the high-level initiates functioned as human divining rods, building a charge with the sound and light that built a charge that transmitted from one pyramid site to another, because you can see one from the other, as you notice in the pyramid code.
Yes.
And that the whole band of peace was resonating at the same time with this huge energy that then was able to transmit through the grid of the planet and connect to other pyramid sites by design.
And this all done at one time for one purpose?
I think it was to hold the energy high when we knew that the things were going to slip, because the Golden Age is highly refined energy, multidimensional and all of that. And the Iron Age is dense can be, where people walk around thinking, what do you mean you can have a past life? Yeah, you can.
Meanwhile, at the beginning of your researches, you were still working at the university in Canada and you were going back there. What did colleagues make of you?
Well, I know how to wear different hats, and I wasn't, you know, telling them directly. Everybody's got, I suppose, a private life. And I did my job well, and my colleagues, you know, I got along just fine with them. And I got my work done on time. And so the secretaries liked me too. And every once in a while, there'd be a little interface between the two worlds. And they'd say, is this you? And I'd say, yeah. And, is this you? Yeah. Every once in a while, someone would find out, because they were looking around for this kind of stuff. And they'd find me.
You're so right. I mean, in a very, very small way, and it's not really analogous to you, and maybe it is. You know, I work on news desks and read the news and do various things to make money. And I also do this, but I don't really talk about it. And every so often somebody will say, is that you? Is that you talking to Garmin Bolter about ancient Egypt? You can keep those things separate.
Well, yeah, but why should we even have to worry about it? Like, what kind of a world do we live in where we're told what to think? We think we're so advanced. We're told what to think. We're told what to talk about. You know, it's just, to me, living in this world and having my day be filled with interviews such as this and the real research that I'm doing and filmmaking, you know, it's like, I don't have to interface. I don't have to play, you know, the other game. And so it becomes, you know, more and more curious how thorough the system has been to tell us what to think.
And how conditioned we've been. And I mean, again, I cannot disagree, even in the slightest, with you about that. What you're discovering, what is beginning to unfold, though, what use is it to us, do you think? Is it a warning from history? What is it?
Well, I think it is evidence of a time when we didn't have all the garbage overlaid on top to say, you know, so that we would give our power away to the doctors and to the priests and, you know, to the teachers and all of that. And so I think there was a time when we were far more free and the technology, you know, was more advanced, and that the stuff of the technology was hidden at some point because the density was coming. And so it's impossible to speculate, except there are certain laws, if you will, of archaeology, that older is deeper, and that it would have been almost certainly of a different time frame. And that's the other caveat that's put on our whole culture, is that we're 5,000 to 6,000 years old. The Bible says so, the Quran says so, school says so, and dating labs say so, because they don't want anything to be older. But the thing is that there's all these out-of-place artifacts and million-year-old skeletons. Michael Cremo, you know, brings us the technology on that with, you know, potassium-argon dating techniques. And
every year, more discoveries of that kind that show that what we've been told cannot be right.
That's right. But the other thing is that patriarchy's best trick is to divide. Cultural anthropology can't speak to social anthropology, can't speak to geology, can't speak to any of it. Psychicness, no. And so we can't put the pieces back together unless we look at every domain. And universities insist that people be so highly specialized that they're not cross-disciplinary. And I've managed to study an awful lot of things. I've got 12 years post-secondary. And so I have blended it all from the academic level. And there is a way to piece it back together. Now, part of it, you know, our psychics that go into these deep, deep places. I know quite a few people who are gifted psychics, and you know, they're thinking of places that are like 450,000 years old, deep underground. I traveled in Egypt in 1995 with a woman who had visions of moving through these chambers, and they were dark. And as she moved toward they lit up, and there were light keys that opened the doors. And so you can just dismiss all of that, or like me, spend your life trying to figure out what does that mean and where is it. And so this place that you're referring to, I've been looking for, actively looking for 25 years.
Right. And this is the time, I think, to talk about what you have now discovered.
Okay. So I spent 5 years in and out of the holes in the Giza Plateau before they put up the big wall, under supervision, with permission. And, you know, I was convinced that there was something down underground. And I also had seen a picture from 1910 of the Temple of Isis. Ah, Temple of Isis. There's another one in Upper Egypt. But I knew that there was this whole network of passageways. And I'd also, way back in 1996, had heard a woman named Chelsea Floor talking about going up the Great Pyramid, two-thirds of the way up, somehow doing some abracadabra mantra to open a door, and then going down, 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 most certainly below the surface of the earth, as high, as deep as they had started high on the pyramid. And in there were these chambers that had technology and things that looked like discs that would have fit in a machine, kind of sounding like computerish, you know, huge open well-lit rooms that deep underground. And as they approached this place, they were talking about this musty and dusty, sounded dank, like totally gross. As I was reading this book, I was just like creeped right out because of how nobody had been into the part. And then they arrive at the real chambers, and all of a sudden it's all modern and clean and well lit underground. So I'm like, well, what's that? And now one of the things is they say, well, if you go inside the Great Pyramid, well, that's all an author has to do, is tell you a different pyramid, and you won't know where to look. And so there is an awful lot underground at Giza, and the passageways are mostly blocked, and they were used for various things. And so that level of field work wasn't wasted, but I came to the point where I realized that this particular place I was looking for was not there. Okay. Now, this is a separate story from the other one I told you, because the other one, when I stepped on the stone, that was Giza. That was the Sphinx Temple, actually. Mm. And then this friend of mine kept on saying, look, there's a place. And so someone came up with a photograph, and I ended up going on GPS and finding the location of this place. And I organized, this is in 2012, in February, I organized an expedition to go in with a hot air balloon and a Russian scientist and this fancy equipment, Dr. Konstantin Korkov, and a film crew from New York. And
it's straight out of Raiders of the Lost Ark, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. And it was a military zone, and we had to get permits to go in there, and there were unexploded landmines, and it was dangerous beyond. We had to, you know, camp with the whole crew and the balloon crew and the film crew on the desert because it was in the middle of nowhere. And we located the place and used the GPS and the whole thing and got there. And it was obvious that this place was completely modern, but it had characteristics like 30-foot wide walls and this trapezoid shape. And, you know, and we were tuning in to the deep underground. And then we got there, and it turned out that it was a target for the Air Force. There's pictures of this on my website, pyramidcode.com. And so it was falling apart after about 30 years. I thought, we are not the most sophisticated we've ever been. Our stuff doesn't even last 30 years, and it's breaking, right? But from Google Earth, you can't tell that. So it turned out that it was simply a target, but we use the sophisticated equipment that actually measures gravitational fields and stuff on the Earth, but it measures the resonant frequency. And the Earth was still disturbed from having these bombs dropped on it on that spot. Anyway, so we came home and, okay, forget it. Okay, so now that's two big things that I've done trying to find this place. And then in December, it started all over again with a site that is well known in history that I had seen before, but I hadn't connected the dots. You can't connect everything until you can connect it. And again, there was no GPS. There was no coordinates, and so I sat here for 2 days looking at ancient maps, looking at Google Earth, trying to line up the two, and I found the coordinates, and then Klaus Donner, who's a colleague, he called me up from Vienna, and I said, I think I found something, and so he went into his system with his friend, a logarithmic system that is very sophisticated quantum physics that is software that attaches to live satellite scans. And within 2 days, he came back to me and said, this is earth shattering. This is a big, 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 big discovery. However, it's not really a discovery until you go and excavate. And so the thing is, though, is now, 8 years ago, they went and did ground penetrating radar by laying wires on the ground and came up with shallow anomalies. But that's not what we're talking about here. This is exceedingly deep. There's four distinct layers. So at the top, which was excavated by Flinders Petrie, I just came back from the site a couple of weeks ago, that was the Roman layer. And then you go a little deeper and it's the Ptolemaic layer, Antony and Cleopatra. But these two layers, pardon me, are 60 and 120 feet deep. And they don't connect to each other, and they don't look like the same kind of construction.
And we think here it's remarkable where we, you know, various parts of the UK, we have Roman artifacts 6 or 8 feet, maybe 10 feet down. But this is of a completely different order.
Okay, think. 1910 was a particularly interesting year because we had Champollion, we had Darwin, we had Freud, and we had the beginning of archaeology. So I think all these people were in the same salon smoking their cigars. And so if archaeology has only been happening for a little over 100 years, the deepest is the oldest is what we're just coming to find. But also we didn't have the sophisticated technology. Now, this particular logarithmic scan can look through layers. And so anything else that they've got out there, and there are other people who are doing quote-unquote space archaeology, but they don't have the software program that gives an energetic signature to all these different elements. So bone, water, precious metals, precious jewels. They do oil and gas, but they don't want to be working on that because it's not good for the planet. And did I say bone? Mm. Okay, so things like gold, water. And they do a different process for each element and scan the whole region again to see where these places coincide. And so, and if there's something below, you can look through that layer. And so there's a tremendous amount that's been found there, and it turns out to be 82 chambers in an area that's 81 football fields wide.
That's astonishing.
And there's a kilometer and a half of passageways connecting these things, but 6 of the chambers are as big as Olympic-sized swimming pools.
So, question, who would have been able to, and who put those things there?
But that's, again, that's our... I prefer a different question, because that's our obsession with Mr. and Mrs. Poseidon from 105,000 BC hired the 123 building company to put it there. Is that satisfying? But that's what we do. We want to have who, where, how, when, right? And it's not useful. I mean, what can we say about it? As I keep saying, older is deeper. Oh dear. Sorry. No. And so we can speculate around that. It's definitely going to be speculation. I'm not even sure if we go and do an excavation, if we can manage to get permits to dig, that will give us anything more. I mean, it could be so freaky what's in there that, so it's all, and it makes me uncomfortable because I don't want to say it's from here, it's from there. But we know from ancient texts that Atlantis had 3 calamities. Right. And we also know that Atlantis came in quite organized with, a seafaring, worldwide seafaring culture. And everywhere you see those, the circles as Plato described, that was for their port, and they built their cities similarly. And we know, people say, well, was it here? Was it there? Was it Bimini? Was it, outside the Straits of Gibraltar? Was it the high altiplano in South America? All of the above. It was a worldwide culture. But where did they get their information from? And so we start talking about the third party hypothesis, and you see that the Mayans and the East Indians and the Egyptians and the Sumerians, they all talked about the wisdom of the ancestors and the powers of the ancestors. And if you look in ancient Indian texts, you'll find, things about vimanas. I'm not saying that word right, but it's the flying ships. And I mean, we're locked in. And as I said, the agenda of the patriarchy is to erase evidence of everything other than itself. So we've lost our vocabulary. We've lost our imagination of what this could be. And we've lost our ability to look way back in time. And the Pyramid Code made that contribution by showing a timeline, by showing the processional cycle to get us at least thinking in 26,000 year chunks, because that's Plato's great year. But how far, let's go back even farther. We don't even know how to think about that. So as I keep saying, if the deeper you go, the older it is, and the Roman and the Ptolemaic are way above, these are likely going to be two time frames. And one thing that's clear is the two levels don't connect. So it's not snakes and ladders. It's not like KV55 and Ramses' tomb that has 72 rooms that go up and down between them. Well, let's just say this. It's not like anything we've ever seen. And so one of the archaeologists that I studied with, he was supervising me in my archaeological work. He has done a lot of work on the Arabian Peninsula looking at, for example, 4,000 years of the frankincense and myrrh trade route. So that's beyond the little countries that the Middle East has been divided into. And then 3,000 years of the disbursement of the technology for pottery in the whole area, right? Mm-hmm. So we're talking lots and lots and lots of layers and the cultural archaeological record being excavated and dated. Okay, so there's a dating technique where it can show the last time something was heated to extreme, which would be the perfect dating technique to use for pottery shards, right? And so, you know, he would be able to say, because of the characteristic features of what this scan is showing us, that it's pretty clear we haven't seen anything like this before. Now, places like Obleki Tepe in Turkey have been discovered in the last 13 years. And it's clear that no one lived there, sort of like Stonehenge. People would go there periodically. You know, they would honor solstice equinox. They'd come and have big gatherings every 7 years, but they didn't live there. And this seems to be something like that, because the rooms don't connect and they're so incredibly huge.
And people here are starting to talk about what is underneath Stonehenge. That's a question that I heard posed only recently. You know, it's not just a bunch of stones on the surface.
Well, and now we have the technology to go look, but that doesn't mean we have the cooperation of the governments to actually go look.
Well, herein lies another point, doesn't it? The willingness of the, in this case, the Egyptian government, but governments in general, to allow people to explore. And if they're not allowing you to explore, that begs the question that we have to ask, why not?
Well, I mean, the whole world is stopping us from coming up with new information, because if we get the truth about ourselves and our distant past, we won't need the government, the doctors, or the priests. We just don't need them. And so we're all
convinced. Doesn't that assume that somebody at some level already knows what's there?
Well, there you go, maybe. Well, these are all questions that can be discussed at length, and we may not get an answer. But it doesn't seem that governments have been very forthcoming in terms of allowing people to go and explore. So I don't know what the statistic, but I think it's something like only 10% of Egypt has been discovered. But over the 30-some years I've been, you know, examining it, probably longer, not that much has happened. You know, it took them decades to get some additional buildings out of the Temple of Queen Hatshepsut in Deir el-Bari. You know, they've got a temple to Mut at Karnak. Karnak was, there was an earthquake and a lot of it fell down. So if you look at old pictures, you think, oh yeah, okay, they're rebuilding that. But ever so slowly, when there's so much more to do. Now, They've got a blanket statement. There's 12 pages of guidelines for a Supreme Council of Antiquities application to excavate. And the first line says, no new permits to excavate will be given in Upper Egypt. And then in brackets, it says from Giza, you can just see this online, to Abu Simbel, which is pretty much everywhere there's a temple or a pyramid.
This site you're talking about, by the way, unless I missed it, you haven't told me specifically where it is. And I'm guessing that's for a reason.
Well, I can tell you if you want. It's 95 kilometers south of Egypt. South of the Great Pyramid. And it's called Hawara. There's a mud brick pyramid there. And it's not, this has been talked about. Herodotus talked about it in 450 BC. Pliny, Strombo, all of these people who were 600 years apart who wouldn't have been talking to each other, they're talking about it. Okay, and so, and Flinders Petrie, who had a decade from 1881 to 1891 of digging in Egypt and doing rudimentary archaeology, he's the one that excavated the Roman layer and found a lot of good stuff that's in the Petrie Museum in England. And anyway, so the site is there and it's known. And so it's been called the labyrinth. They say there's 1,500 rooms on one level and 1,500 on the other, which from the scan doesn't quite add up. But, you know, I guess if, you know, there's a way, you know, so they didn't know either. Let's just put it that way. And it's certainly older than them. And so Herodotus talks about being on the upper level, but he couldn't get into the lower level, but there were people talking about it. So if it's known, 1, 2, 3, 4 different groups of people over long distances of time went there and put things there, including the pyramid. There's something to the site. But the other thing is that the site is 30 kilometers from the Nile. And in the pyramid code, we see that the Sphinx is eight miles.
8 miles.
I don't know if it's kilometers. I thought it was miles from the Nile. You can measure that right on Google Earth. So how long would it take the river to migrate? Because now the water table is percolating back up at the foot of the Sphinx. So, you know, the Nile did used to flow right in front of it. And I think that's been shown geologically as well. So 30 kilometers from the Nile, you know.
We're talking about orders of thousands upon thousands of years.
That's correct. Now, we've got people like Zachariah Sitchin, who's on the other side now, but he, you know, and lots of people are, I call them Sitchinites. They want to just repeat everything he said, but he was unverifiable. But he talks about 450,000 years ago, as does this renowned channel who's at, you know, been verified a lot of different ways, 450,000 years ago. Well, then what are we talking about? So if Atlantis had three calamities and they started to be able to predict them, and this is in ancient texts, there's a prophecy that says when the head of the crab hits the heart of the lion, which basically means that the Cancer constellation and Leo will collide. Well, something did happen that knocked the axis of the Earth over by 14 degrees and the whole thing went down. And that may have been the last time that Atlantis actually went down. And it's on the ceiling of the Temple of Dendera in the calendar of catastrophes. It pinpoints 13,660 years ago. That's when that happened. But we're also told there's records 17,500 BC. There was another calamity, and before that. So there's people who've, you know, written things, Enochian magic, lost knowledge, Ancient of Days, stuff like that, that refer, and I also, you know, the first regression I did in 1973, I'm dating myself here, I sound old, don't I?
It was a very good year.
In Atlantis. You know, that when we knew it was going to go down, there was a group of us, and if it was you and me and, you know, 10 other people, we know here comes the asteroid. What are we going to do with the stuff? What are we going to do with our technology? How are we going to protect people? So to me, because of the shapes of these rooms, having stared at these scans for the past several months, the chambers don't only not connect up and down, which stands to reason that it would be two different groups that did it over a long period of time apart, but the rooms themselves seem to be isolated blocks.
So do you think this was like some kind of repository, the ancient equivalent of dry storage?
Yep, that's what I think.
Wow. You're so driven, you can't just leave it at that.
Well, we've been working on permits, but, you know, because the intellectual property of the pyramid code was put on YouTube and 40 million people watched it, I'm still, you know, it cost me a lot of money to make that, and I have like 20% of it back.
That is astonishing, because I watched the pyramid code and was enthralled by it, and I saw it on YouTube in full HD quality today, and I did think, somebody's lost a lot of money on that.
Yep. I'm $450,000 short, and it's not fair. And so I protected the intellectual property because I had to find the first site. I had a photograph, but I, you know, the site in February 2012, and I found it needle in a haystack, There was a date actually on the satellite scan, and I called the company and they said that it was over Egypt. Could you be more specific? And then I literally found it by just looking from Google Earth, which it's like finding, you know, a house in a whole city, and you have to find it just by, you know, looking at the characteristics of it. Anyway, so I took it upon myself to find the other one, because the other team had driven there and they didn't have the GPS. So then when I found it, and I also had access to Klaus, and he offered to use the technology. So this was and is my intellectual property. And, you know, so other people are interested in working with me, and no sooner are they trying to say it's theirs, but it isn't theirs. So
in,
I never.
In a sense, it isn't anybody's, is it? I mean, you're not fighting to keep your intellectual property. You're keeping to, it sounds like you're trying to stop a whole bunch of other people grabbing it and saying, mine. In a way, the way that you sound like you operate is that this is knowledge for the world, really.
Well, and that's the point. If somebody gets their hands on it, if there is a dig, I want to be filming.
Of course you do.
So that humanity can see this, because the chances of it getting buried, misinterpreted, just badly done are extreme. And so my point isn't to get the glory. My point is to make sure humanity sees it. And, you know, then it starts to be infighting that they're, you know, disputing that it's mine. And then, then they kick me off my own team, where I don't know where they got the idea that it was their team in the first place. And then they realize they can't do it without me and all this stuff. It's just so much a waste of time.
But this is such a big site, and it's so far down, it sounds to me like it would need a multi-billion dollar multinational consortium to be able to do anything about it.
Well, good luck with that. But it's but it's archaeologists that need to do it, and they can come from a variety of countries on a foreign mission. But there's so many ways that things can go sideways that, I'm not that optimistic, and I'm coming out with this now simply because, you know, there were people trying to say it was theirs. So I made a few phone calls and went public with it last week, just because, I don't know if anything's going to happen in the future or how that's going to work. However, this archaeologist that I worked with years ago was in charge of the Queen of Sheba dig in Yemen, and I was a candidate for the expedition there in 2000-2001 when that ship blew up in the Yemeni harbor and then the whole thing was shut down. But this Queen of Sheba dig in Sabah, Yemen, they would arrive and the temple was full of sand. So they'd get this sand removal equipment, much like they built those islands in Dubai with. And they'd suck out, you know, they'd spend days and days and days vacuuming the site, and they'd go in with their little paintbrushes and take pictures of one corner. It would take them, you know, 2 months to do that, and then they'd go back to the University of Calgary, and then the whole temple would fill up with sand, and they'd come back the next field season and suck out another corner and go in with their paintbrushes and take pictures. And so eventually they ended up photographing most of that site. I don't think they were finished, but they never went back, and we never did that expedition. But sand removal equipment like that could work. Now, this will be up to archaeologists. I'm not an archaeologist, though I did study archaeology. So people have to be signed, sealed, certified, do field work. And so, you know, I'm preparing a list of, you know, suitable people. But there's rules and rules and rules. And they don't want, you know, they want people doing more than one thing. And then they don't want people doing more than one thing. And there's all these different ways. But I've applied for a lot of these kinds of permits working for the Ministry of Education in Taiwan. I was a professor over there for 4 years, and three of the years I was granted international academic cooperation projects. So I'm used to the responsibility of these large-scale projects. There would have to be archaeologists that would be responsible for the actual dig and the logistics of it. But some people say, well, just go with a bulldozer and get 100 people with those little leather buckets. And that doesn't sound prudent. Because the site would be soft. So that would still be up to them. But we don't have 25 years with all the political changes going on to take it out a bucket at a time. Mm. Right?
Yeah, well, that's a very concerning thing, isn't it? I mean, with all this political turmoil, who knows what might be done to that site? I mean, I didn't want to refer to this, but look what ISIS is doing in some ancient sites, knocking them to pieces. Anything could happen in this crazy topsy-turvy world of ours, couldn't it?
Well, and hiding it is one thing, which is why I'm coming out. And, you know, the whole thing makes me nervous. I'm not sure if that's the right course of action, but I was going to hold on to that intellectual property, not let somebody else say it was theirs. So I don't know what happens next. And, I mean, probably anybody in charge doesn't want me talking about it, but, you know, like, I don't have a gag order on myself.
So it sounds to me like you're a mix of excited and scared, too.
Well, fear isn't the thing. I mean, I'm more, if there's fear, it's fear of how people behave.
So at the moment, are you sitting by the phone waiting for a starting pistol to be fired on further exploration of this site? Where are you at?
I have a list of 18 potential archaeologists that meet the qualifications and the characteristics, and I'm supposed to submit it to the Supreme Council of Antiquities in the next couple of days, but I also don't know what they're going to do with that. I mean, they could take all the information and run with it as well, because it's not that easy to evaluate archaeologists, and somebody who hasn't studied archaeology isn't in a position to do that. So in a way, I'm doing all this work, not knowing if someone's going to, because, right, you know, in this day and age, we're all a bunch of pirates, right? Get the information, take it, say it's yours. So I don't know how. I'm working with somebody who works for the Supreme Council of Antiquities on an application.
And if you get green lights all the way, and you're anticipating you may not, there may well be obstacles, and sounds like there will be. But best case scenario, when could you be there doing this?
Well, it's premature to say that. We're coming into Ramadan on June 18th, which is a month where nobody works. And then you've got the heat of summer. The SCA only meets every 8 weeks. I don't know.
It's Happy New Year, 2016. Or 17.
Well, the thing too is that a field season is 8 weeks. And so I don't think we should, you know, prepare to do 25 field seasons. I think we need to just go in there and do it as efficiently as possible. Now, we have talked about boreholes and, you know, 3D cameras that do the mapping and that sort of thing, but that's still not a discovery unless, and archaeology is a destructive science. So you have, you know, an excavation means you actually move stuff around that will never go back the way it was, but that's the definition of archaeology.
And if I was to ask you at this stage for a sentence to explain to Bridge Joe in the street why we need to be doing this, what would that sentence be?
We need to be doing it because it gives humanity hope that there was another time frame where things function differently, and that we don't have to be enslaved by the system we're in right now, being told we're free. It's another way of being and thinking that I think is refreshing.
So actually, it's a way out of this prison that a lot of us feel that we're in today. And it's a way of reversing the car out of the cul-de-sac that we're headed down, you think?
Yes, I do. And I think that even now, knowing that it's down there, because the reliability of this scan is proving to be quite stellar over the years. It's been used in a number of countries by governments looking for diamond mines in Brunei and gold in Bolivia, and they're finding it, then they're going and digging and finding it. So it's being referred to as spooky accurate.
And if you're listening to this now, wherever you might be listening to this now, and you think, well, you know, is anything of any great interest going to be found down there? Think on this, because one of the things that came out from the Pyramid Code were these hieroglyphs that looked like rockets and helicopters from a period before there were rockets and helicopters, supposedly. That's one of the reasons why we need to do this, isn't it?
Well, yes, and even that was covered up. And so it's about, I can't remember now, but, you know, 10, 12 years ago, somebody's standing in the temple and here comes a piece of stone from near the ceiling, comes tumbling down off a lintel. And that was underneath. And then you had everybody scrambling around saying, oh, no, that's just a hieroglyph. It looks like a plane, but it's a combination of these two, the bird and a...
It's an optical illusion. Yeah.
Yeah. And then everybody was sworn to secrecy. No one was allowed to point it out. And of course, I go in there with my group and, you know, get them all behind me and point up. And people are like, what? I don't see it. And then finally they would see it because it's not that big and it's really high. And the other guides around, well, how do you know that's there? We're not allowed to show our clients. We know it's there, but how do you know it's there?
Well, oh, Carmen. We've had an amazing hour and 5 minutes or thereabouts. I said to you when we spoke last night before recording this, I'd be keen to talk with you more than once. I don't know whether you'd have time to do more of this at some point in the future, but I'd love to talk to you again.
Sure.
Your enthusiasm is absolutely infectious. And, you know, not many things excite me in this day and age, but what you've been saying certainly has, and that's a fact. So thank you.
Thank you.
If people want to know about your work, where, is there a one-stop shop on the internet for people to find it?
Yeah, pyramidcode.com.
Carmen Bolter in Canada, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
The remarkable Dr. Carmen Bolter, whose enthusiasm, I'm sure you'll agree, absolutely leaps out through the audio that you can hear. What a remarkable person, and we'll hear a lot more from her, we know. And I'm just delighted that she was able to speak with us here on The Unexplained, and I do hope that she can come back to us very soon. If you want to get in touch with me, send me an email or a donation for the show, your reflections on the way that I'm doing things here, maybe a guest suggestion. Your guest suggestions always gratefully received, especially now that I'm one show down because of a problem I had with a previous edition, as I said at the top of this show. So guest suggestions, send them to me at theunexplained.tv. You can follow the link and send me an email through the website. Thank you very much to Adam, my webmaster at Creative Hotspot in Liverpool, for all of his hard work on this. And above all, as ever, thank you very much to you for your support and being with me every step of the way, even if we'll never meet. Thank you. My name is Howard Hughes. I'm in London. This has been The Unexplained, and until next we meet here, please stay safe, stay calm, and stay in touch. Take care. Thank you. Bye-bye.